Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, UNC religion professor Bart Ehrman has written, more than 20 books, including several New York Times best-selling books, in which he's examined the origins of the books in the New Testament. And he's explained those things to us, and we've learned that maybe not all of the books were written by who we thought they were written. But in his newest book, which is just coming out, the book is titled Forged: Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. Dr. Ehrman says that these books are not only not written by the people we not all of the books written by the people we think might have written them, but that many of them are forgeries, written by forgers. Now, Dr. Ehrman, that's strong language.
It is strong language, yes. It's an interesting phenomenon. New Testament scholars have known for a long time that a number of the books of the New Testament aren't written by the people that are claimed as the authors. So that, for example, there are 13 letters that claim to be written by Paul, and scholars for a long time have said that six of these probably were not written by Paul. But scholars have been reluctant to call these forgeries. A forgery in modern parlance refers to something's written by someone claiming to be someone else with the intention of deceiving. And my contention in this book is that that's exactly what's going on in early Christianity, not just in the New Testament, but throughout early Christianity. I look at documents from the first several centuries where I think, that the people who were doing this really meant you to think that they were the person they claimed to be. In other words, they wanted to deceive their readers.
Forgery or not, it was common practice. I'm putting words in your mouth, so correct me. It's common practice among early Christians to write documents and books and letters and to pretend to be someone else.
Well, yeah, it wasn't just common among Christians. It was a practice in the ancient world, probably more so than today, because it was much harder to detect when somebody had done it in the ancient world than it is today, because far fewer people were literate and they simply didn't have the means but to check to see whether the actual author was the pretended author. So it did happen a lot, and the mistake some scholars have made is thinking that since it happened a lot, it must have been a sanctioned practice, that it must have been acceptable. What I do in this book is show that, in fact, when ancient people talk about this practice, they condemn it. They don't look upon it favorably at all.
Well, if they condemned it so much, why is it so prevalent?
Yes, well, that's a good question. You know, there are a lot of things today that are widely condemned, that are widely practiced. I think, for example, the use of illicit drugs is widely condemned, but it doesn't seem to stop a lot of people. And, you know, cheating on taxes and committing adultery, they're both condemned, but they're widely practiced. And forgery was looked upon as a deceitful practice, and yet a lot of people did it. It is an interesting question, though, what motivated these people to do it, and that's one of the things I deal with in the book.
Well, as I've looked at your book, a lot of what you review and tell us in the new book, Forged, is not inconsistent with what you have said in your earlier books about scholarship. And in those books, you made a strong point almost always to say, I'm not telling you anything that mainline scholars at the mainline seminaries wouldn't be familiar with. They might not agree with me on every detail, but on the main stream of evaluating the source of New Testament books and the scholarship that surrounds early Christianity, we're in the same boat. It's only those who just go to church and hear the preachers who've been trained at those seminaries that. Just to say this in a short way, you said nothing that you said would surprise those scholars or would get anything other than a little bit of disagreement on the details. But now when you use this word forged, Or that's going to change a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the difference is that my two previous books that that we've talked about, I think, were books that were trying to make available to a wider audience what scholars have long been saying. The difference with this book is that it's not simply digesting what scholars have always said. It's based on about 5 years of solid research of original research that I've done in the ancient world, where I've discovered that what scholars have long said about this practice, what scholars have said is often wrong. Scholars talk about these books of the New Testament and will say that they're not written by the people who claim to be the authors. Scholars will commonly call this a practice of pseudepigraphy, which is a nice big word which sounds antiseptic and harmless because nobody knows what it means. It actually comes from two Greek words that together mean a writing that is inscribed by a lie. Well, scholars will use the term, but they won't tell you what it means. They'll just say it means
somebody used another name to attach to their writing.
Right, but it's not like it's not like when Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn and signed it Mark Twain, because he wasn't claiming to be somebody famous. He was just taking a pen name, and the instances I'm looking at are instances where a person doesn't take a pen name, but actually claims to be a known person. And so, whoever wrote the book of 1 Timothy was claiming to be the Apostle Paul, and he wasn't the Apostle Paul, but he really wanted you to think he was the Apostle Paul, and he succeeded. So over the centuries, of course, most people have assumed he was the Apostle Paul. And my claim in the book is that he was doing this on purpose. He knew what he was doing. He knew he wasn't the Apostle Paul, and that ancient people who talked about this practice said negative things about it.
About the practice, but not necessarily how it was done with Paul's books.
There were debates about a number of the books that made it into the New Testament. A better example is actually the book of 2 Peter, which claims to be written by Peter. The author says he was present at the Mount of Transfiguration to see Jesus transfigured. But almost all scholars, except for conservative evangelical Christians and fundamentalists, everyone else who studies this agrees that Peter did not write this book. Ancient people called that kind of book a lie. That's the term they use, pseudos. The other term they used for it actually was much more unsavory and is worse than our word forgery.
Just explain that word.
Yeah, so, right. So the other term that was...
As much as you can on family radio.
Okay, I will choose my words carefully.
No. Just go right. Just let it loose.
The Greek word for this kind of book is nothos, and it's the Greek word for bastard. And so these books were called bastards because they didn't belong to the people that were alleged as their parents. They were illegitimate children. And so there were debates about 2 Peter, whether in fact it was a nothon or not. And up and through the 4th century, there were church fathers who said this was not written by Peter. It is a lie and it is a bastard.
Well, I want to get back, and let me warn, or let me invite you to think about the idea of, I think you've started a debate, and there'll be more, maybe there'll be more debate even in the mainline community about the your assertions about, or your conclusions is a better word, about the use of these types of, I can't even say the word,
pseudepigraphy.
So I have to say forgery
That's good.
Just because I can't say the other word. But one of the things that sort of startled me when I got back into this, introduced to the Bart Ehrman scholarship routine, was that in looking at the New Testament, which is real important to me, that if we follow that the only books that I can now solidly say were written by the person I thought they were written by are 7 letters written by Paul, that all the rest of them are attributed to people who didn't write them. I mean, have you pulled that rug out from under me all the way?
Yeah, I'm sorry to kind of being the bearer of bad news, but the that part of it is in fact not very controversial among scholars, as odd as that seems. There are the seven undisputed Pauline letters. A number of the other books are not what I would call forgeries. For example, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not forgeries because the authors don't claim to be people named Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Later people said this book was written by Matthew, this book was written by John, but the author didn't make the claim, so there's no intent to deceive there. But with six of Paul's letters, whoever the authors were claiming to be Paul when they weren't, the authors of 1st and 2nd Peter claiming to be Peter when they weren't, and so forth. So some of the books are forged, some of them are simply wrongly attributed to people who didn't write them, and that's the case with most of the books of the New Testament.
We're visiting with Professor Bart Ehrman about his most recent and latest book, maybe his most controversial book. It's called Forged. He and I'll be right back after this short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Bart Ehrman, distinguished professor James A. Gray. Professor of religion, former chair of the religious studies department here at University of Chapel Hill, and author of more than 20 books, some scholarly, important scholarly books, others best-selling, New York Times best-selling books, examining what we know about Jesus, about the writings about Jesus, about early Christianity, and in this case, primarily about New Testament books that may have been written by people who were forgers.
Yes, people claiming to be famous persons whom they were not. Not easy to say that, but so that's what we would call a forgery.
Let's talk about some of the books. One of the great books of the New Testament is Ephesians. Some of the really beautiful language in it, but you pointed out, and other scholars have pointed out, this is probably not written by Paul.
Yes.
But how did it make its way into the New Testament? And, I mean, it must have had something else going for it other than just that people may have thought it was written by Paul.
Well, in Ephesians is like a lot of the other books that I'm calling forgeries, that people might call pseudepigrapha. It's a book that claims to be written by Paul, but when you compare it to the seven undisputed letters, there are very clear and distinct differences that have made scholars for a long time argue that Paul probably did not write it. But whoever wrote it was trying to sound like Paul. And so a lot of the book does sound like Paul. There are some phrases in Ephesians that people say that is vintage Paul. You're saved by grace, not by works, that it's faith that saves you. It's a beautiful book in the opinion of many Christian readers over the centuries. My question isn't whether it is right in its theology or if its ethical exhortations are admirable. My question is simply a question of authorship. Did Paul really write it or not? And in this case, we're fortunate in having seven letters that Paul almost certainly wrote so that you can compare a book like Ephesians with the other seven. You can look at the writing style in Greek. You can look at the theological expressions. You can look at historical context, a range of things, and decide whether this is consistent with what was going on in Paul's own letters. And when one does that, it looks like Paul didn't write it.
Well, let's just, as you say, scholars agree, many scholars agree, and the majority of scholars agree that Paul was not the author of Ephesians. But Ephesians made its way into the New Testament. I'm looking for a lifeline here.
Yeah, okay.
Throw it
yes,
to me.
Yes,
I guess that there were other standards that went into the selection of the books that went into the New Testament. And if I were on the selection committee, which I wasn't, and but there were people, they made their way into the book having met other standards other than just having been written by Paul.
Yes.
And that the language, the doctrine, was consistent with the Christian faith as the people who were making these selections saw it, so that it, not written by Paul, even if written by a what you call a forger, it's good stuff.
Yes.
And is it?
Well, that so yeah. So that I guess that's my point is that that the theological claims of the book should be judged on the basis of their theological value, not necessarily based on whether the author was a forger or not. If the early Christians who decided which books to include, if they knew Ephesians was not written by Paul, they would not have included it. That's absolutely the case. They would have called it a pseudos, a lie. But they thought Paul did write it, and they thought it was perfectly consistent with the Christian point of view, and so it made it into the New Testament, and since then has been formative for how people have understood Christianity. And so I don't want to take away from that, because it is a very important book. And so I just have the sort of more simple point is that the author was lying about his identity. And it's striking in this case because Ephesians stresses the importance of telling the truth. And so it's a bit ironic that the author, in order to tell the truth, had to tell a lie.
I've heard other scholars, mainland scholars, I don't want to say they've glossed over this problem that you've raised in your new book, Forged, but they've said, consistent with what you said, there are seven books that were written by Paul and six other or others that were not written by followers of Paul, some say, or they would might say of students of Paul's, disciples of Paul, part of the school of Paul, writing in a group of Pauline people.
Yes.
Are these people deceiving? Are they throwing me the lifeline that isn't there?
Yeah, I'm afraid they are. So as I was saying earlier, when I was writing this book, Forged, I did a lot of research. I spent 5 years doing research for this book. Last year, I had the entire year off of sabbatical, where day and night I did nothing but read ancient sources on the problem of forgery. One common line that scholars of the New Testament say is that it was an acceptable practice in philosophical schools for a disciple to write a book in the name of his master. So whoever the teacher was, if you were in the Platonic school or the Pythagorean school, you would write a treatise, but you didn't take credit yourself. You'd give credit to where credit was due to your master, and so you'd claim to be Plato or claim to be Pythagoras. And so I looked into this claim. Most New Testament scholars who say this, I used to say this for years. For years I would tell my students that. But then it occurred to me I didn't know a single piece of ancient evidence that was the case. And so I decided to look up the evidence. And I talk about this in the book, that in fact the evidence is extremely thin. We have nothing from the time of the New Testament, not a single indication that this commonly happened in philosophical schools. In fact, that it happened at all in the philosophical schools. Our first evidence that we don't even have evidence that it happened. We have one comment from one ancient author that this sometimes happened. It's an author named Iamblichus, who's living about 200 years after the New Testament, who says that this sometimes happened in the school of Pythagoras. Well, Pythagoras was living 800 years earlier. And so this, how would he know? And so scholars of Pythagoras don't think that Iamblichus is right even about that. So there is really very little evidence to suggest that this happened in some kind of school setting.
So your conclusion is that even in these forgeries, even in these New Testament books that are forgeries, forgery is condemned, and it was widely condemned throughout the ancient world, and that this is the new scholarship that you bring to bear, both in terms of the world of scholarship and also for those of us who are lay people who are interested in these things.
Yeah, that's right. So this book, as I was saying, unlike my other books, this isn't simply regurgitating what scholars have always said. I'm actually trying to advance knowledge somewhat in this book by showing that, in fact, these common explanations for why there are these sorts of books in the New Testament, these common explanations probably don't hold water.
Were you excited about the possibility that your colleagues in the scholarly community are going to go after you now and debate debate you on this point.
Right. I think the book may be a little more controversial than the others. What I'm doing now is I'm writing the scholarly version of this book. This book is for a popular audience, so it's for people who don't have the background. But I'm now writing the scholarly version. The scholarly version is much longer, much more detailed, because most of the scholarship is in German, and the sources are all in Greek and Latin, and so it's complicated. I've written about 500 pages so far. I have about 300 more pages to go for the scholarly version. So it's a big book.
Well, thanks for writing this one for us first.
Yeah, you're welcome. So it will have a lot of the substantiation that people who want to dig deeper will be able to find.
We're visiting with Professor Bart Ehrman, professor of religion here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, about his new book, Forged Here, and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Dr. Bart Ehrman about his new book, Forged. The subtitle is Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. How'd you come up with the title and the subtitle?
Right. So a little known secret is that authors of books like this have virtually no say in their titles.
Oh, really? Is that right? Even yes. When you're a best-selling author?
Like, oh, no. If you're
How does the negotiation go?
The negotiation works like this. They come up with the title, I complain about it, and they go with it anyway. And so I actually wanted to call this book God's Forgers. Which I thought was a little more clever and playing off some other best-selling books like God's Secretaries and some others. But their view was that my other best-selling books have had two-word titles, Misquoting Jesus, Jesus Interrupted, and they thought God's Forger sounded too much like that. So they wanted something that was a little bit bolder, and I understand that. You know, that's fine. I think the problem with the title is that it's more sensationalist than the book is. The book is actually grounded in completely solid research, and it's, I think, easier to object to the title than to the book.
Well, the title is controversial, and it raises defenses. It did with me. I just, why in the world is he emphasizing this? Why can't he just use that old word that I can't pronounce?
Pseudepigrapha. Yeah, that wouldn't sell books, would it? Pseudepigrapha.
Yeah. God pseudepigrapha. Right. Yeah. Well, maybe those guys up in New York know what they're doing.
Yeah, right.
Well, I want to press you to do what you might not want to do, but what you're going to have fun doing, I think, and that is what – I guess you do – in your book you mentioned some of the people who've taken the viewpoint – without substantiation, you say that this is a forgivable practice. This was a practice that was going on all over the ancient world. It's not something to be afraid of to say that the books were written by someone who pretended to be somebody, that the books of the Bible, some of the books of the Bible were written by somebody who was different from who they said they were. Now, who's going to jump on you? And what are they going to say, and what are you going to say back?
The people who are going to most object are evangelical Christians and evangelical Christian scholars, who some of whom deny that the phenomenon happened at all in the New Testament, who will tell you that Paul wrote 1 Timothy, he wrote Ephesians, Peter wrote 1 Peter, and Peter wrote 1 and 2 Peter, and that these books are all written by the people who are claimed as their authors. A number of people will object to the term forgery because they think it has negative connotations that are inappropriate. What I try to show, as I pointed out, is that the ancient terms are equally negative.
So is the debate going to be like the one we've had about the use of about your choice of terms rather than about any of the conclusions that you came to about the prevalency of this and the acceptability of this sort of
thing? No, I think some scholars will try to argue that, in fact, it was an acceptable practice, but I'll be very interested in seeing what evidence they adduce, because I've read everything I can get my hands on from the ancient Greek and Roman sources, and I've read, I think, everything ever written on the subject in French, German, or English. And I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it was an acceptable practice. And so if somebody does come up with evidence, that'll be a good thing, because it'll mean it will have advanced scholarship. But at this point, I don't know really what somebody could appeal to.
Can I try to jump on you from a different direction? And that is, you say that you've read the scholarship of the modern languages about this event, but I'm accepting this as the use of forgery and the evidence that backs it up, and your evidence that it wasn't acceptable as being sort of new scholarship. But is it really based on some modern scholarship as well in Europe?
When I said I've read all the scholarship, I mean all of the scholarship and what people call pseudepigraphy, which is that there were books written in the ancient world by people claiming to be someone other than who they were. And there's extensive scholarship on individual instances. And so you mentioned Ephesians earlier. There's a ton of scholarship written on Ephesians. I don't claim to have read everything ever written on Ephesians, but there's a ton of scholarship on the individual instances. And there's a lot of scholarship on the question of whether pseudonymous works should be admitted into the New Testament or not, or whether they should have been. And so there's a lot of scholarship on those two issues. What there's not a lot of scholarship on is the broad question of how pseudepigraphy, how forgery worked in the early Christian centuries, including the New Testament. And so that's where my contribution to scholarship is going to be, is this scholarly book I'm doing deals with how this phenomenon functioned in early Christian arguments, Christian groups arguing against each other, Christians arguing against Jews, Christians arguing against pagans, how people pretended to be famous authors writing books in order to attack those they disagreed with.
Well, this is an area of great interest to me. And when you use either the books of the Bible, or in the case of your scholarship, some of the books that didn't make it into the Bible, to give us an idea about what Christians were arguing about or undecided about in the first 100-150 years after the time of Jesus and Paul, and what were the big issues, and how did the forgers play a role in having the wide body of Christians decide which way they were going to go on some of these questions?
Right. Well, I'll give you one, for instance, because there are hundreds of things, but I'll give you one thing. There were debates in early Christianity about whether Jesus was really a human being or not. There were Christians who said that Jesus is God, and since he's God, he can't be human. So eventually, of course, the view emerged that Jesus was both human and divine at the same time. But there were Christians who said...
I apologize. I want to do this again. Was that a compromise, or was that a reasoned...
Well, it's a great question, because there were people who thought he was God, but he wasn't human. There were other people who said he was human, but he wasn't God. And the position that emerged was that he was both things at once. And so I don't know if you want to call that a compromise position. It's almost as if the final decision was taking the best of both positions and eliminating the worst of both positions in the opinion of the group that won out. So there were books written by people claiming to be apostles that said Jesus is divine, but he's not human. And so, for example, there's a gospel that didn't make it into the New Testament called the Gospel of Peter. It actually claims to be written by Peter, the apostle. And it eventually didn't make it in because church fathers decided that it had this wrong view, that Jesus was divine, but he wasn't human. There were letters allegedly written by Paul that argued that Jesus was divine, but he wasn't human. They didn't make it in either. So the people who decided which books to be included were also the people who decided that Jesus was both human and divine. And so the decision about which books to include hinged on the previous theological decision about who Jesus was.
Well, help us. One of the things that you can help us with is that some of the women in my church shy away from Paul in some respects because of some of the things that he says about the role of women in the church and some of the things that in the family. And do you provide any help, or do you and the mainline scholars provide any help by saying, oh, don't worry, those things weren't really written by Paul?
Well, that's a really good point, because Paul, in some circles, some, I would say, liberal Christian circles, Paul is often looked upon as a major misogynist, somebody who was against women. And one of the main reasons for thinking that is because in 1 Timothy chapter 2, Paul says that women should be silent, they should be submissive, do not have authority to teach, have no authority over men, and if they want to be saved, they should have babies. And so that doesn't go down too well with a lot of women today. Well, the reality is Paul didn't write 1 Timothy. This is written by somebody claiming to be Paul.
And was that consistent, though, with Paul's thinking?
I don't think it was. The passage that seems like it's like that in Paul's undisputed letters is in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 34 and 35, which it's in a book that Paul really wrote, but scholars have contended for decades now that these two verses in particular were added by scribes, that they weren't really there in Paul's writings for a lot of technical reasons. But it means that Paul, when you look at Paul otherwise, apart from these two passages, Paul has women in his churches who are deacons, women who are apostles, women who have churches in their homes, who sponsor churches, who are on the missionary field. Paul had women active in his churches. And so I think that, in fact, this label of Paul as a misogynist is precisely built on these forged passages.
We're visiting with Professor Bart Ehrman. We're talking about his new book. It's called Forged, subtitled Writing in the Name of God, Why the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. And he and I will continue our discussion after this short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Bart Ehrman's my guest. He's the author of Forged. This is, I don't know, this is one of 20-some-odd books that you've written. But you've only written two or three New York Times bestsellers, two or three or four, I mean.
Three. Who's counting?
Well, and this one, we'll see. This one, based on early views, this one's going to be a best-selling book as well. One of the curious things for me is that, and it's real important in the standard analysis of New Testament writings, is the language that was in use in Palestine. You make the point that it's just virtually impossible for Matthew, for disciples like Matthew and John to be the writers of these eloquent Greeks, because they just didn't know Greek. They grew up speaking another language. And my impression had always been that Jesus probably spoke Aramaic, maybe Hebrew in the worship language. I read recently in a new book that there was a lingua franca of just a dirty Greek language that was prevalent throughout Palestine during this time period. You give that, you don't salute that conclusion, do you?
No, I don't. I think that's probably wrong. This isn't, this view of mine isn't based on my own personal research. It's based on the best research that's out there right now, which is that Palestine in the first century was largely Aramaic speaking, except for in the major cities. So in Galilee, where Jesus lived and where John lived and where Peter lived, the two major cities were Sepphoris and Tiberias. Jesus and the disciples didn't come from either city. They came from rural Galilee. And every indication is that in rural Galilee, they spoke Aramaic, and there was no reason for them to learn Greek. And so unless they, the other thing that I point out is that the only way people learned how to write was to go to school. And the scholars who have studied literacy in ancient Palestine are now arguing that at best, something like 3% of the population could read, let alone write. Far fewer could write, and far fewer than that could compose in writing. We actually only know of two authors from that part of the world from the entire first century. And so the idea that someone like Peter could write highly literate Greek like you get in First Peter, it really boggles the mind, because he would have had to go back to school as an adult and take Greek and then take composition classes and become skilled in Greek composition, and it seems really, really unlikely.
Well, Paul was one of those authors. You concede that Paul and Josephus, I mean, who were the other?
Paul wasn't from Palestine.
Oh,
Paul
I see.
Was from
okay.
outside of Palestine.
Okay.
Josephus and one other author whose writings no longer survive. And Josephus himself, Josephus was a famous first century historian, but he spoke Aramaic, and he tells us in his autobiography that he had trouble learning how to write in Greek. He had to have people help him, even though he was the very upper crust elite in Palestine, unlike people like Peter and John, who were lower-class fishermen.
Well, it's interesting to me because the stories that we get in the Gospels of would make you think that Jesus was able to read the read the Scripture and to debate the Scripture with the elders. These stories maybe not credible?
Well, scholars debate whether Jesus could read. I think most scholars today think Jesus was not able to write, at least. Yeah, I mean, that he wasn't writing literate, but you know, in the Gospels, there's only one Gospel passage which indicates that he read. Luke chapter 4, he reads, and he would have been reading in Hebrew, because that would be the language of the Scriptures, and it's possible that Jesus was exceptional. There were 3% of the population.
We're running out of time, but today, a Jewish child has to read the Scripture in order to be brought into the community of his synagogue.
Yes. And
that just didn't, I mean, the scholarship indicates that's something new. That wasn't happening back
yes,
there.
Yes, that's the mistake. A lot of historians will tell you that in Palestine, Jewish boys also went to synagogue school to learn how to read, and that's another modern legend, apparently.
How do we know? I mean,
you have to look at what the ancient sources actually say, and you have to look at all sorts of literary evidence, and you look at what ancient people say about educational practices, and you look at all sorts of ancient evidence, including archaeological evidence, to see what levels of literacy were. And so there's an entire book devoted to literacy in Palestine, where the author argues, based on looking at every piece of ancient evidence, that probably 3% of people could read.
Well, one other thing. One of the books of the New Testament has always given me trouble, I mean, is Revelations.
Yes.
And so I wasn't too disturbed to learn that the disciple John probably didn't write this, but you're not so hard on whoever. You said there were a lot of Johns, so maybe he wasn't a forger.
I don't think he is a forger. I think this is a case that I actually call homonymy, which is where somebody has the same name as somebody famous. So there were a lot of people named John in the ancient world, and whoever wrote the book of Revelation happened to be somebody named John. He doesn't claim to be John, the son of Zebedee, the disciple. And in fact, there are indications in the book of Revelation that the author is not claiming to be John, the son of Zebedee. And so I think he was simply a prophet named John, and so that would not count in my books as a forgery.
Why did that book make it? This is off the topic of you. I mean, this
no,
is not
no, it's an important question. If people ended up thinking John the son of Zebedee did write it, that's why it got included, because they thought it was written by a disciple. A book that almost made it in was the Revelation of Peter, which claimed to be written by Peter. And into the 4th century, there were people saying that the Revelation of Peter belongs and the Revelation of John does not belong. These were debates people had, and it was partially based on whether the book was really written by the person claimed as the author.
Along those lines, what do evangelical scholars say about the your claims that Peter could not have been literate? The real Peter could not have been literate, or the real John could not have been literate because they grew up in these illiterate times? How do they get around the problems that you and other scholars present to them?
Well, I'm not sure how they get around them. They necessarily have to say that Peter was literate because they think Peter wrote 1st and 2nd Peter. One common claim is that what Peter did is he used a secretary, and that he told the secretary what to write so that even if Peter couldn't write, the secretary wrote for him. And that's another modern scholarly myth that I try to explode in my book to show that, in fact, even though this is widely claimed, there's very little evidence that kind of thing happened.
what could have happened if you were.
Well, it could have happened. I mean, you know, Martians could have come down and given them computers. No, it could have happened. As a historian, one simply has to look at what evidence there is for the use of secretaries. People did use secretaries in antiquity. What people did not use secretaries for, so far as we know, is telling them to write a book for them, and then they would write the book. We have no evidence for that kind of thing happening.
We're almost out of time, and I've been pressing you all the way through, and I've never given you a chance to say, in your own words, uninterrupted, what the importance of your new book, Forged, is. And so take a minute or two and just give us the elevator speech for that, for the book.
Well, I think it's an important issue whether the people who were writing the books that became scripture were telling the truth about their identity. I'm not trying to cast any doubt on the truthfulness of what they say, their theology or their ethics in terms of what they're telling how to people how to live. But by ancient standards, these people who were claiming to be someone other than who they were, by ancient standards, these people were telling lies. And I think that that is worth knowing, that ancient people would have looked upon books like this as pseudepigrapha. They would have looked upon them as books inscribed with a lie, which means that if they are conveying the truth, these authors thought that it was more important to lie about their identity than to come clean about who they really are. And there was an ancient, ancient practice for this, because there were people in the ancient world like today who thought that sometimes it's better to lie than to tell the truth in some circumstances, and that sometimes a lie can promote the truth. And I think that's what's going on with these authors. They thought that the ends justified the means, that it was perfectly okay to lie about their identity in order to convey what they understood to be the truth.
Well, Bart Ehrman, thank you. Thanks for writing the book and for defending it so nicely here. I look forward to the debates about your book and to the scholarly book that will follow this one. Bart Ehrman is a professor of religion here at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the author of Forged, Writing in the Name of God, Why Bibles, the Bible's Authors Are Not Who We Think They Are. Thank you, Dr. Ehrman.
Thank you.
Thanks all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking, and we'll be right back here soon.